Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and I'm delighted to have you with me today. This is a program that's brought to you each week by the VHL Family Alliance. Von Hippel-Lindau disease is abbreviated VHL, and I'd like to play you a little bit of information about VHL before we get going, and then we'll be right back to talk with our special guest today about unpolluting your environment, getting rid of the pollutions and the irritants that are in your environment. Dr. Lisa Nash. Welcome, Dr. Nash.
Hi, it's Lisa Nash. How are you?
Great. I'm glad to have you with us today. This is a topic that's really of very keen interest to me because I went through an episode of this myself several years ago, that I'm very sensitive to hydrocarbons, and finding that out was quite an adventure. So tell us what you can about how you became involved in this arena.
Well, I think that I didn't really pick the title, you know, for the topic today, and I would include, if you were going to retitle it, something to do with mold exposure and health effects of mold, because one of the most common environmental pollutants in the home or in a workplace, in an indoor building, is going to be the mold problem. And it's sort of the hallmark syndrome of environmental illness can develop from any chemical exposure, but most often mold exposure is really what people, you know, say that has happened before they become sensitive to other chemicals. And so then,
so how do you determine whether you have the wrong kinds of molds around in your home, or do you?
Well, I think people often present to me when they are either deathly ill, or they know that they've got neurologic disease or fatigue or chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia, or they're severely chemically sensitive because they didn't realize the mold was a problem in the home for so long. So there's a lab called P&K Microbiology, and you call P&K and you get, you know, 10 plates for culturing the mold sent to you, and you put them in the fridge. And then you open each plate for an hour in each room and compare it to outdoors. And you can then close the plates and look at them. And on the fourth or fifth day, the mold colonies grow, and you count them. And you could use probably a sour cream tub as well, because you know when you open sour cream, there is occasionally a spot of mold on it. And it's not the sour cream.
Right.
It's the home that's causing that to grow. So any culture medium, you know, that will pick up these molds, you can compare and find out, is the mold content lower in your home? Because it should be lower inside than it is outside. And your house should be dry to help mitigate mold growth. And problem is, people don't realize that the humidity should be kept at like 50% in the home, and instead they have it between 60 and 80%, and mold will grow even if they don't have a water leak.
Interesting. So there are kinds of molds that are not particularly terrible for us, but there are other kinds that are. Is
right.
that true?
And if somebody, you know, if you can go backwards, if somebody is chemically sensitive and comes with fatigue and symptoms, you say, well, have you had mold exposure in the past? And usually I say, have you ever lived in a house with a musty basement? So you go from when they grew up, did they have a musty basement then? And they can say, no, my health was pretty good until I was 25, and then, you know, my family moved, or I got my first house, and I moved into a place that was didn't smell right. But then I got used to it. And so over time they get used to it, and they adapt, and then they start to get more and more symptoms of either headache or fatigue. And a lot of the symptoms are fairly interesting. Do you mind if I list some symptoms?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so when somebody becomes a little environmentally ill, they can be intolerant of perfume, the detergent aisle of the grocery store, diesel exhaust,
right.
And then any other chemical smell, like Lysol or something, I shouldn't probably say a brand name, but, you know, chemicals that have very strong odors that are particularly, by history, are usually a problem for people who are chemically sensitive. The mm-hmm. other symptoms are people can have, like the bra, when they wear a bra, it could be too tight because the tissue is thick and it really has a lack of oxygen. So people who are environmentally sensitive often haven't worn bras for a while, and they do tank tops or other things because the regular bra is just unbearable to them. Clothing tags can become itchy on the back of the neck. So a lot of autistic children cannot tolerate clothing tags, and a lot of environmentally sensitive people will just notice that, even for 5 or 10 years, that they'll cut the tags out. But they won't really realize they're chemically sensitive, and one of the reasons is this concept called masking. And masking is when you wear perfume or you use traditional smelly fabric softener and detergent. I was trying not to say the brand names there. But anyway, so you're wearing things that smell, and you then can't tell you're chemically sensitive because you're masked and covered up in smell all day long. And that's what happened to me. I was an emergency physician, and I was working, and I put perfume on every shift, and I had no idea that I had chemical sensitivity because I wore perfume. So the first step when you see a patient is to tell them, stop wearing perfume, change your detergent, and come back in 5 days. And it's a weird thing, but after 4 or 5 days of living in either in a cleaner environment, if you're in a clinic, or just stopping wearing scent and going unscented, people will then show their colors and can observe in their environments what's bothering them by using smell.
Interesting. So just by changing your detergent, stopping wearing perfume, and what was the third one?
Well, a lot of the patients have changed their environment. So let's say they're in a scented environment with Airwick solid or some sort of a Christmas tree hanging in their car. They take all those scented products and put them away because they have a lot of chemicals. A friend of mine named Ann Steineman has published recently. There are like 20 toxic and carcinogenic chemicals in air fresheners and laundry detergent and fabric softener. And people don't realize this is a really big part of their toxic load. So all normal people would benefit from basic principles of what makes chemically sensitive people get better. They should consider modifying their lives so that they have less chemicals that they're exposed to every day, and then their general health will be better, even if they don't think they're sick.
I went through a period about 20 years ago now where I was working in a fairly new building. It was a nice-looking building, and it was well-built. But I found that I tried using contact lenses, and I found that I couldn't wear them after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. My eyes began to feel gritty. And I also couldn't stand to work more than 3 days in a row. So I got into a pattern of working at home on Wednesdays. And my boss was joking with me that I was allergic to work. But, you know.
Do you think that's what it is? Do you think the workplace was the problem?
Well, it was, actually, because I went down to personnel and I said, you know, I don't know what's going on, but there's something in this air that's making it very difficult for me. You know, and I told her about both the contacts and the having trouble being in the building 3 days in a row. And they were very responsible about it, and they put an air quality measuring thing in my cubicle. And what they discovered was that there was, in fact, a break in the air ventilation system over my cubicle, so that even though the building was exchanging air at the rate that it was supposed to by law, the air around my cubicle was not getting exchanged. And there was a high concentration of hydrocarbons exhaust from the Xerox machine that was nearby. So when they made those changes, then things happened, got a lot better. But it's amazing to me, you know, the sensitivities, at least for me, were hydrocarbons, the exhaust from the photocopy machines. If I walk into a photo development store, I just like have to hold my breath and get out of there as soon as possible.
Carpet glue. Or if you go into the beginning of like a Sam's Club and they have the tires in the front, a lot of patients will notice that they can't be near rubber.
Yep. And I had always wondered about the little sheets that you put in the dryer and how much that was adding particulates into our environment. So tell me about those.
Well, did you ever hear of being chemically sensitive or know about environmental medicine before?
Not really, though. My ophthalmologist had similar sensitivities. Hers was actually worse than mine, so we commiserated a little bit, and I learned a little bit about it. But, of course, this was 20 years ago. But nonetheless, I mean, it was clear to me that there were certain irritants in the environment that I needed to stay away from, and I didn't realize that it was as widespread as you're saying.
Well, this is I'm not sure who our audience is, but the problem we're trying to I'm trying to educate and you know get medical school education to incorporate taking an environmental history and there's some real political stumbling blocks to education. One of the issues is that women get sick with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and chemical sensitivity 4 to 1 over men. So 4 times as often. It's a women's disease, and so when you have a workplace problem or you have a I don't know if I have the leaves are blowing outside. Do you think it's too loud? Should I shut my door? Are you okay?
No, we're okay.
Okay, because I hear it's just the wind is picking up here. It's a beautiful day. I live on Martha's Vineyard, by the way, so it's sort of a nice place with good air quality.
Yeah. Well, women are more often, I think, to wear perfume, and especially those with hydrocarbon propellants. And also we spend a lot more time around laundry products, I
right.
think, than most men.
Well, the
do.
Other thing is that there was a very interesting study on the whole mold issue by a guy named Dr. Thurman, who was in the Army, and they study molds and mycotoxins because the Army knows that this trichocytine family of mycotoxins is used as a bioterrorism agent. So it was called Yellow Rain, and it's been used over the decades. And when it's sprayed on soldiers, apparently it burns the skin off of soldiers and it kills them. So the Army's done a lot of work on this particular bioterrorism agent, and therefore we have some data, you know, to expand to the general population because this is the same toxin that people get exposed to in their homes in a moldy environment. Okay, so that's number one. Then the study he did was on rats exposed to trichocytines, and only the female rats got death of the adrenal gland. And therefore, were adrenally insufficient, and the rats would die from the stress gland being killed. And the male rats didn't get this. And the second study he did was to give testosterone to the male rats, the female rats, and the female rats survived fine and didn't get death of the adrenal gland because of the protective effect of testosterone. So we see a difference just in men, you know, humans. I see patients every day come in as couples where the man thinks he's not sick. The woman is obviously complaining of fatigue and chemical sensitivity, but the man may have memory loss, skin rash, belligerence, maybe cognitive impairment where they can barely find their car in a parking lot. But they look normal. Mm. They don't really complain. They're not going to complain until they become sick, and it may take maybe 5 years before the man catches up with the woman and becomes a sick. And often when that happens, they've already divorced. Because usually the women will have these symptoms.
Fascinating.
And I've helped a couple thousand families for free when I was sick before I was working. And the same thing over and over again. So I wrote an article. It was in LA Yoga called Mold and Marital Discord. And it was about couples not getting along when they had mold exposure and how they often divorce. Because it's so common.
Fascinating.
Men do not, for some reason, I mean, I like men. I have no problem with men. But observationally, men do not usually believe that mold can hurt you. They're less likely to leave the home. So the woman will often take the children and leave the home, and the husband will often stay in the house and go down with the ship. And so they'll divorce, he'll keep the house. Very interesting, you know, phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it could be similar in hydrocarbon exposure or other exposures where the person is, like men deny that if they stir pesticides with their hand or they spray pesticides in the house, that anything will come of it. So they're, there's a machismo about it, and they want to say,
stuff,
I won't get sick.
Let's talk for a minute about perfume, because this was another part of the chemical exposure episode that I had. I was working for a woman who had her signature perfume that she was very proud of, and she would wear a lot of it. And to me, this perfume smelled like benzene, but she swore it smelled wonderful. And it was to the extent that the people in the cubicle next to her had a fan. And when she came in, they would blow the fan in her direction to get it out of their cubicle. But she refused to think about it. So once I learned about my hydrocarbon sensitivity, I went down and looked at a box of her bottle of perfume and discovered that it had in it a hydrocarbon propellant that was to push this fragrance into the air. But to me, all I could smell was the hydrocarbon.
Well, that's because
so it's very interesting.
Whatever.
You know that.
Yep, sorry.
That instead of, I mean, perfume started out as extracts from flowers.
But now
and just with alcohol and flowers, that's one thing. But now that they have chemically prepared scents and propelled into the air by hydrocarbons, it's much more of a chemically polluting kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think that one of the interesting things is not only what's in perfume, but why perfume wearers can't let it go. They become addicted and defensive about perfume. And if you suggest that a person should stop wearing perfume, even for 4 or 5 days, to test and see how they feel, they are unable to go without it because there's a stimulation they get from perfume when they put it on, and they'll go in withdrawal. So they'll go into a withdrawal syndrome if they take away foods that they're addicted to, perfumes, other scented products. They need it to function, and their liver is used to breaking it down. And so there's this fear, and not only a psychological defensiveness, but a physiologic response to taking people away from the offense. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Sometimes I'll get into a taxi cab, and he not only has one of these little trees, he has three of these trees in the car, and I'm rolling down the windows. I mean, one time I even said, you know what, I have to take the next cab, because it really does. It begins
well, what
to
people
right
that
out.
Have chemical sensitivity should be prepared and have a mask. They should get a charcoal mask, usually from Dallas. There's a place called the Environmental Health Center of Dallas, and I was treated by Bill Ray, and now we're colleagues. And they sell a great charcoal mask. And people who are chemically sensitive, the first thing I give them the first day they're here is a mask for their pocketbook. And one time here and there when they are in an airport and have to cross where the diesel buses go, or they're in the grocery store and they can't handle the detergent aisle, but they have to go get something, you know, at the other end of the aisle, like Borax that's non-toxic, they need to be able to protect themselves, because society isn't going to make everything easy for us and make the world unscented. But the patient has to be responsible, educate themselves that they have chemical sensitivity, and then figure out how they're going to mitigate their reactions so they're not acting like a fruitcake. The idea is not to scream and say,
right,
oh, my God, I can't handle this. Get away, get away. No, you say, well, I'm chemically sensitive. I'm going to turn away, pinch my nose, go get fresh air. If I need to do something, I'm going to wear my mask and take care of business, because over time, we can get a patient well so they no longer have the syndrome. But in the meantime,
right,
patients have to understand what the syndrome is, and having a charcoal mask is, you know, part of the deal, so that they can be at a function, and if something
right
happens, you know, they can get up and move, which is like on an airplane. If somebody's wearing perfume and you sit next to them and you're chemically sensitive, it's hard. You have to get up and move.
Right. I was in an airport one time, and it just simply stank of this a detergent that smells like a pine woods, only worse and worse.
Right.
And it just stank of it, and it was all I could do to just walk through the airport.
Well, part of the problem that I was going to say before, just in terms of the politics of this, is I got sick and didn't know what I had. I went to Cornell for medical school. I went to Penn undergrad. I'm a smart enough person, and I'd never heard of chemical sensitivity, and most other lay people
right
have heard of it. Most doctors don't know anything about it. And this problem of thinking the patients are just psych cases, as opposed to saying they have a physiologic syndrome, is really
right
damaging. And I think that the reason it is that men in medicine have been looking at these crazy women and giving us a label of psychiatric imbalance, instead of understanding from people like me, who I'm a physician, I can explain what happened and explain what's happening with different parts of the body that lead to these symptoms. And we are treated as if there's no relationship between the brain and psychiatry and behavior and physiology. And so when somebody's
right
physically sick, they're going to get symptoms that are psychiatric because they've got hormonal problems. So I have Addison's disease, environmentally induced adrenal insufficiency, just like that study on the rats. My dog
wow
has adrenal insufficiency, and my husband has it. It was all induced
oh
by mold.
Oh, my goodness.
And then
huh
if you were adrenally insufficient.
So have you moved out of the house? Or
oh, yeah, I mean, a
decade
ago.
So, but how does one treat a house like that? I mean, you hear all these horror stories about they had to rip through the walls and start over again practically.
Well, I think my area of concern is more how do you treat the people, because the house is toast. If you have a house that's filled with Stachybotrys in the walls, the toxins are in everything, it may not be salvageable. And so some people have a mild exposure and they can remediate the house, and they have to figure out if they can tolerate it. But in general, for very sick people who get sick from a home, the advice is, you know, you can try, but even if you remediate the house, it may be okay for other people to move in who are not yet sick. But people who are very sensitive to the antigens of that mold, there'll still be remnants of it, and they'll never be able to get well in that house. So they often have to move. And some people, you know, make a decision whether they're going to tell people, like the house needs to be bulldozed and let somebody else build a new house on the property. But some are milder exposures where it's just a little bit of toxin and more allergenic. So it's nice to test for the toxins. So there's a lab called Real Time Labs, and it tests for trichocytes, aflatoxin, and ochratoxin. And the test is not, you know, not cheap. It's $700, and it is not usually covered by insurance. And this is the way we're able to now see that many autistic children are positive for the aflatoxin. The mothers of autistic children are often mold exposed and chemically sensitive. And so there are a lot of diseases where we're going to find there's a relationship in part of the people who have the condition. So part of the group of autistic children are going to be mold exposed. Some of them will be pesticide exposed. Others of them will have other exposures either in utero or after birth. And then the thimerosal in the vaccines is like the icing on the cake. So you've got toxic kids, can't detoxify well, then you give them the vaccine, then they may be symptomatic. So the realm of disease that's related to environmental exposure encompasses almost all diseases. So everybody, if they had their druthers, they would have an environmental physician to look at them and say, well, I've got headaches to red wine now. Why is that? Oh, well, you've got adrenal insufficiency. Why is that? Oh, you've got a musty basement. Okay, well, let's dehumidify, clean up the situation. Oh, I feel better. I'm not so tired. I'm able to drink a little wine and not have a headache. So that was easy enough to fix this patient. But sometimes more has to be done if the symptoms are becoming neurologic, like MS or Parkinson's. And if it's related to mold exposure, you don't want to stay in that house anymore.
Right. And if you're not sick, just what do we need to do as a preventive? Just reduce the chemical load in our environment.
Right. And a lot of people think that they won't become that ill, but then they get MS 15, 20 years down the road. So you never know what's coming down the pike. So the idea is be preventive and proactive. If you have an exposure, right, you're getting mild symptoms, deal with it early, get a good workup, figure out how to stop the ongoing exposure so you can recover,
right,
and then lower your toxic load. And one of the mainstays, is this show going on for 30 minutes or 60 minutes, by the way?
I would like to keep it around 30.
Okay.
Most of our listeners are podcast listeners.
Okay, because I wanted to say that it would be ideal for people to have an oasis bedroom where they put a charcoal air filter in, they have a hard floor, no carpet, and then they start to detoxify at night instead of absorbing toxins in the bedroom. So this is one of the
main
theories.
That's a great idea. I have a chlorine filter on my shower, too.
Yeah, and I have a whole house filtration system where the stainless steel filter holds charcoal and filters the water. But see, a lot of people will buy like a plastic water filter for their tap water. And you really don't want to filter in plastic. So ideally, when you spend money, ideally you would spend money in the right direction and not have to redo things twice. So, you know, we give people advice to find an environmental physician. There's a website called AAEM for the American Academy of Environmental Medicine, and that's AAEM.com. And they have a list of physicians around the country who basically know this. And I'm trying to take it to the next level where all physicians will have some of this training in medical school. And then when a doctor finds somebody who's getting sick, they can refer them to an environmental physician so they can quickly get them well as opposed to searching for years to figure out pieces of the puzzle that they can't put together.
Great. So let me just reinforce that. So it's at www.aaem.com,
right,
the American Association of Environmental Medicine. You can find a doctor who's up on these things because most doctors are not.
Right.
And you probably also want to take a look at Dr. Nagy's website, which is lisanagy.com. lisanagy.com.
Right, so it looks like
and she has a lot of fascinating information about it. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, so, I mean, I think that it's an interesting field, and I think that when I give lectures now, I explain that 70% of women over the age of 40 become a little environmentally sensitive. So So it's a very ubiquitous phenomenon. It's not like a rare syndrome. And a lot of people know somebody who got very sick, but most people you ask will have some symptoms where they have like the headaches from wine, other clothing tags bother them, and they don't realize that it's related to their anxiety or their ADD. It's all tied together. And if you take apart the pieces of the puzzle, then the person will feel well if you fix their nutrition, you know, their hormones, their environmental exposure, their, you know, potentially their dentistry may have caused a problem with mixed metals in the mouth. There are lots of different factors that make people fall off the cliff and become ill. And they shouldn't wait and basically not use psychiatric drugs as a Band-Aid to getting real help. Because the psych drugs, I mean, they're useful so that you don't care that you're sick. But they don't fix the problem, and you'll continue to sort of downward spiral. So anybody who's on an antidepressant or on ADD medication, I think this is something they should look into because they may have had it start off with either mold exposure or pesticide exposure if they used to work on a farm, or they could have had a job like you and you got exposed to something at work, like new carpeting can cause this. And a lot of people don't realize that they just aren't the same in their 40s and 50s as they were when they were 20. They start getting symptoms.
That's interesting because mine did start after my 40th birthday. And the other thing that was that still is an irritant to me, not as bad as it used to be now that I'm in my 60s, but is the carbonless carbon paper.
Oh, yeah, that's a big problem for people.
Yeah, it used to be I had to pick up my telephone messages on these carbonless carbon paper things. And by the time I got back to my desk, my eyes were watering and things like that. So it was pretty clear to me what some of the irritants were. But as you say, there are a lot more that are around us that we may be getting low-level exposure to. And I sometimes say I feel like the canary in the coal mine. You know?
Yeah, well, that's I mean, there are a lot of newsletters,
and
they're all called canary news because that's this area.
Yeah.
But so even people like you who got sensitive a while ago maybe didn't know about environmental medicine and could have benefited because when you have the eyes irritated in the afternoon, cortisol, the stress hormone, which prevents allergy, goes down at 4 o'clock. So it makes sense. Your cortisol is going down and your eyes become irritated. And then if you have adrenal insufficiency mildly, you may need a replacement of either cortisol, DHEA, or aldosterone. Those are the three hormones from the adrenal gland. And if you have adrenal insufficiency, you know, people feel low blood pressure, maybe dizzy on standing because they don't, you know, they don't have enough salt and water. They can't hold on to salt and water. So they're like chronically a little dehydrated, and they may be depressed, but they definitely get fatigue, and they can get anxiety. So if you want to read about hypoadrenalism or adrenal insufficiency, some of the people listening will maybe recognize that they have it. And then, unfortunately, traditional endocrinologists only like to treat severe Addison's, not mild adrenal insufficiency. So you need to go to an integrative or an environmental medicine physician to sort of get this assessed. And it shouldn't be that difficult to get well. And in closing, the one thing I want to mention is this phenomenon of dysautonomia, where people get a fast heartbeat when they stand up. So people who can't stand up for a long time have a conversation with their legs apart. They need to cross their legs, or when they sit, they'll pretzel their legs. They have this thing called dysautonomia. And it's basically treatable with medication. And after you treat an environmental patient for a few years, the dysautonomia will improve because they've done sauna and detoxification, and then they'll need less medication. But dysautonomia is something known about by traditional cardiologists and neurologists, yet it's not recognized very often because no one takes the vital signs standing. So everybody can check their heart rate. You know, you could check your heart rate. You wait a minute. You stand up. You check your heart rate. Then you lay down, and you check your heart rate, you know, laying down. And if it's 20 beats faster on standing compared to laying down, then it's mild dysautonomia. If it's 30 beats or 40 beats, then it's more severe. And a tilt table will help to diagnose that for people who need, like, disability and proof, you know, that they've got a condition. And then treatment is fairly easy, which is midodrine and 4NF. So I just wanted to close with something useful for people in case anybody, you know, needs to know that tidbit as well.
Sounds great. Thank you. Yeah, there's so many people out there searching for a diagnosis and so many ailments that have these sort of creepy symptoms that doctors generally don't appreciate and chalk them up to early menopause or hysteria, which comes from the Greek word for woman.
Uterus.
So, you know, it's often just blamed on, oh, you're just being a woman and you're being a
right,
little
and
too.
Right, and we're really discounted. And I think what's important is that, you know, anybody that can help politically or in the media, you know, I'm flying to, I was in Washington, D.C. last week. I'm on a government committee on indoor air quality and health, building and health and building materials, that kind of thing. We really need help because there's very little funding. There's very little clout behind this movement. And so anybody who has an in with, you know, the Washington Post or the New York Times, we need to have more articles published about this so that people can, the people who have means can push it through, and insurance companies will pay for this kind of treatment and workup. Because the idea is preventing chronic disease and getting to the cause of disease would save billions, you know, tens of billions.
Right, and there's a lot more appreciation now for the tight building syndrome than there was 20 years ago. But nonetheless, there are also more plastics and other chemicals in the environment than there used to be. And generally, buildings don't have windows that open for security reasons. So unless they have a truly good circulation system, they still can do that. So even things like made of plywood, there's glue in plywood.
And formaldehyde.
We don't have desks made of old, of real wood anymore. They have formaldehyde and other chemicals in them.
And you can ask for formaldehyde-free plywood when you're building. I use formaldehyde-free birch plywood because I don't do well with pine. And chemically sensitive people don't usually do well with pine terpenes. So pine wood is not the best thing to use for a floor. Oak is better. And when we buy a sauna, we buy a poplar sauna. I recommend Heavenly Heat because that's the one without any glue and pesticide. And so, you know, if you go to a cedar sauna, the wood, the cedar wood sometimes can make the people sick. So, you know, there's an art to being, I think, to practicing environmental medicine. It started in the 50s with Dr. Randolph, and there's a great book called Alternative Approach to Allergies, which talks about food allergy, chemical intolerance, and then psychiatric manifestations of these, you know, these exposures. It's a really good book. And then there's another book by Stephen Edelson called Living with Environmental Illness, and it explains the Oasis bedroom in 2 pages and what it's like to be sick and how to figure out how to get well. So, you know, I would refer those 2 books as starter books if for anybody who's sick, and then I would say to find an environmental physician to get them on the way to, you know, getting better. And sometimes you have 3 physicians. You know, sometimes you have somebody
who
does the hormones.
And even if it, even if this is not your primary problem, it certainly could be exacerbating a problem.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
so
it relates to hypertension.
You say on your website that 15% of the population is somewhat chemically sensitive and 40% of the population may be affected. So this is not a rare condition.
No, and that's the thing, is that if it's not a rare condition, why aren't we educating in schools about it? And a lot of it has to do with men not believing women and just calling them nuts. So it's got to stop. So anything you guys can do would be great to get some airplay for this.
Super.
And
yes. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I just have a patient I'm finishing with, and I had her take a break while I talk to you. But if anybody has questions, I'll leave my phone number. It's 508-693-1300, and I'm in Massachusetts. And also Bill Ray is in Dallas, Texas. And, you know, if you have questions, the staff at either of those locations can help people.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Nash,
and
I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
Let me just remind everybody that your website is lisanagy.com. That's lisanagy.com, and the telephone number is 508-693-1300. And thank you very much. And again, just want to remind everybody this program is brought to you by the VHL Family Alliance. Please check us out at VHL.org, and the archive of our shows is held at powerfulpatient.org. So we'll be with you again next week, and we hope that everybody has a good week. Take good care of yourself, be well, and be a powerful patient. Thank you.